From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. In what could be a rare defection of a high-profile North Korean official, a senior diplomat based in Italy has reportedly disappeared and may be seeking asylum in a third country. South Korea's spy agency has claimed that Jo Sung-gil, who had been serving as North Korea's deputy ambassador in Rome, went missing with his wife shortly before he was due to be recalled last month. Nick Grimm reports.
Until recently, Jo Sung-gil had been North Korea's acting ambassador to Italy, a plum posting for diplomats representing the so-called Hermit Kingdom. But with his time in Rome due to finish at the end of November last year, he apparently disappeared. Kim Min-ki is a South Korean parliamentarian who sits on its National Intelligence Committee.
His term was due to end in late November 2018, but he is known to have left the official residence in early November. Right now, he has disappeared, and so has his wife.
Unconfirmed reports suggest Jo Sung-gil is currently in hiding and seeking asylum from a still unknown third country. South Korea denies acting as an intermediary. Kim Min-ki again.
The National Intelligence Service has confirmed that it has not been contacted by Jo Sung-gil.
If the defection is confirmed, Jo Sung-gil will join a small fraternity of top officials who have defected from North Korea. Ramon Pacheco Pardo is with King's College in London.
It is not the first time. The latest case that we know of was here in London when we saw another high-profile defector from the embassy, Tae Jong-ho, who is now living in South Korea. He has made a name for himself. But it is true that if we go back in time, you don't see these cases very often. We have five or six confirmed cases over the past couple of decades. So this is a rare occurrence, actually.
North Korea's top diplomats are usually drawn from well-connected and powerful families inside the secretive state, but often they're refused permission to take close family members, including children, overseas with them, ensuring they resist the temptation to defect. And any family Jo Sung-gil has back in North Korea could now be facing severe consequences if he has fled.
Well, we know his wife is living with him in Italy. It is not confirmed whether he has kids or not, but we should consider that at the very least, he's very likely to have his parents, cousins, etc. And the way North Korea operates, these people who are back in North Korea are going to be in trouble. It is likely that some of them will be sent to concentration camps or labor camps, however you want to call them, in which they will have to endure hard labor. Some of them might be executed. We don't know if this will be the case or not, but this could actually happen, and some of them are executed. And at the very least, you could assume that any position of power his family might have held back in Pyongyang is obviously gone now.
Some reports suggest, though, that Jo Sung-gil's children may have been living with their parents in Rome. But right now, North Korea watchers can only speculate on what could be behind the apparent defection. Gene Lee is from the Woodrow Wilson Center in the United States, who in the past has worked as a journalist in Pyongyang with Associated Press.
These are just theories at this point. I think that we're just looking for possible reasons for why he may have defected. But I do think that in many cases with these defections, it's that they know that they will be in harm's way if they go back. So I think that that's certainly a strong possibility. It could be that he wanted a better life for his family and for his children. If he had his family with him in Rome, they may have made a decision for their family to seek out a different life.
There's been renewed unrest and violence in West Papua in recent months, and it's gaining attention across the border in Papua New Guinea. People in PNG feel a strong connection to those on the other side of the island, and there's been some renewed support for a referendum in the Indonesian territory. The calls are also coming from within the government, with a coalition member advocating for a fresh vote and saying he will be pushing for change in PNG's policy in West Papua. Natalie Whiting reports.
They may be on one island, but it's a long way from Port Moresby to the Indonesian region widely known as West Papua. Despite that, West Papua is front of mind for many people in Papua New Guinea's capital.
They're fighting for their freedom, so why don't we give it to them? It's a sad thing, just reading their stories, like, All they're asking for is the freedom. Give it to them.
The PNG government should be helping them. The PNG is failing to help them because they are a neighbouring country.
I prefer if PNG government really look into our neighbouring countries like West Papua.
The governor of the National Capital District, Powers Parkop, says there's a special resonance for Papua New Guineans.
We have a responsibility to them because we are same people, same culture, same tribe, same language, same island.
2018 ended in renewed unrest and violence in the contentious Indonesian territory. Last month, pro-independence separatists were accused of killing 28 people who were working at a state-owned construction company. The Indonesian military has since been accused of using chemical weapons in response, an allegation Indonesia denies. Bloody photos continue to flood social media pages in Papua New Guinea. Governor Parkop says he'll be pushing for PNG to change its policy on West Papua.
Problems in West Papua will not be solved until we give the West Papuans proper, legally and internationally supervised referendum to decide once and for all what they want for themselves. I have expressed my disappointment and differences with government policy now. I will continue to do so, even though, you know, I'm a leader of a political party in the coalition government.
The long-time West Papua supporter says he's canvassed the issue with other members of the government.
I think, you know, there is numbers. It's just having the political will. I've asked the Prime Minister, and I hope that in this new year we will have a discussion in government caucus and also on the floor of Parliament.
Papua New Guinea is preparing to hold its own referendum this year. The people of Bougainville are expected to go to the polls in the middle of the year to vote on whether to remain a part of PNG. But PNG's Foreign Minister Rimbik Pato is remaining firm on the government's position on West Papua. In a statement, he said,
Papua New Guinea and the international community have long recognised and will continue to recognise the lawful sovereignty of Indonesia over its Papuan provinces. Australia, New Zealand and virtually all other Pacific Island countries recognise Indonesia's sovereignty, as has the United Nations.
Last year, Indonesia issued a strong rebuke to Vanuatu over its representations about West Papua at the United Nations General Assembly. Governor Parkop has criticised his own foreign minister's approach to the issue.
We will be on the wrong side of history. The right side of history is the one I'm advocating, and that is to stand up, be strong, have courage to talk about Papua openly with the Indonesians and find a way forward to solution. Yeah. That will be on the right side of history. Rimbik Pato is on the wrong side of history.
His push for change comes as the Foreign Minister, Rimbik Pato, tries to strengthen ties with Indonesia, with a meeting between the two countries planned for next month. In his statement, he said the countries would be discussing a range of joint projects.
The new border projects, added to the existing projects, will help bring the prosperity and ongoing development the people want. Any attempts to stir up trouble with Indonesia by anybody in PNG should be halted and be replaced by support of peaceful projects aimed at boosting prosperity on both sides of the border.
Powers Parkop is speaking out at a contentious time politically in the country, with the PNG government facing the possibility of a vote of no confidence from the opposition. Governor Parkop denies the West Papuan issue could cause ructions within the coalition.
I don't think so. I think we are mature enough to deal with those two issues separately. It's not something that is politically to the extent that it will dismantle the government. Yeah.
To what extent the issue will be taken up remains to be seen.
China's oppression of the Uyghur people appears to be expanding, with intellectuals reportedly the last group to be targeted in a mass government crackdown. At least 100 Uyghur academics are believed to have been sent to camps as part of what the UN estimates is a forced detention of at least 1 million of the mostly Muslim minority group. China's government claims the camps are for vocational training and re-education of extremists, but reports from the inside tell a very different story. We spoke to one Uyghur woman Jugabar Javar, who spent more than a year inside one of the camps under conditions she says were, well, torture. Flint Duffield has more.
Flint, it's very rare to hear stories from people who've actually been inside these camps. Why was this woman willing to speak?
Yeah, that's right, Linda. It is unusual that people are willing to speak about their experiences in the centres. In the first instance, because it doesn't appear that many people in these camps are actually being released. But secondly, many of those who come out of the camps have family members still in Xinjiang or in the camps, so they're understandably concerned about repercussions for their family. And that's one reason that Gulbahar Jalilova is able to speak, even though the Chinese government ordered her not to. She's actually from Kazakhstan, a country which borders China's western province and is also home to a number of Uyghur people. Now, she's a businesswoman who's been travelling between China and Kazakhstan for the past 20 years, and she says in May 2017 she received a phone call from a Chinese person telling her to return to the city of Urumqi in China to finalise a business deal. But when she did, she was met by Chinese police who arrested her on charges of illegal money transfer and sent her to one of these camps for what ended up being more than a year in detention.
Her accounts of the harsh conditions inside the camps very much contradict the claims of the Chinese government about re-education training. To what extent can we verify what she says?
That's right. They're very much in opposition. And in fact, just last week, the Chinese government took some journalists and diplomats on a tour of some of the centres, which appeared to show Uyghur people being quite pleased with the way they're being treated. Some even sang English renditions of, "If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands." But what we also know is that people are not free to leave these centres. There are armed guards patrolling what photos and other accounts show very much to be prisons. And while it's impossible to verify exactly what Gulbahar Jalilova told us, her accounts in many ways do accord with reports from human rights groups and others who have been witnesses to this kind of treatment. Now, Gulbahar Jalilova has since fled to Turkey, which is where I spoke to her through a translator, Mehmet Çelebci. And that's exactly where I began, by asking how she was treated during her 15 months in detention.
They were swearing at us, they were punishing us. Sometimes they were tying up a weight of 5 kilograms to our feet as a way of punishment. If they wanted to punish even heavier, they would put handcuffs and we would be forced to look at the wall across for about 17 hours. And also, once every 10 days or so, the door would be opened and about 10 army officers would come and inspect the bedrooms. After that, they would make us naked and then they would inspect our body to find out whether we were hiding in that naked situation. As a result of that, it affected my health adversely. I entered the concentration camp 76 kilograms and after 1 month, I dropped down to 55 kilograms.
The Chinese government denies that people are being mistreated in these centres. They say people are being fed nutritious food, they're being looked after, and they're going through vocational training. What do you say to those assertions?
All of those things are total lies. We were kept in dark rooms with rats and mice, and we would be taken to questioning, during which we would be beaten severely. And while I was in the camp, they used to give us injections, take blood samples, give medications that we didn't know. And if we asked what medication it was, they would penalize for asking this question. And none of those female people were having monthly periods because they were giving us specific medication that was stopping the periods.
Did everyone have to take the medication or just particular people?
This medication was given to every single person, one at a time. And I can tell you that many people died in front of my eyes while in concentration camp. Those are the facts.
You said people died while you were in the camp. How did they die?
I was taken to hospital 4 times during my stay in concentration camps. Each time I was kept for 10 days. And while I was in hospital, I did see people dying, but I cannot talk about those at the moment.
And when you say you can't talk about the people that died, why is that?
I don't feel safe. I feel scared.
Do you feel scared talking to the media as you are now about what you saw?
Yes, I certainly feel scared. But think about it. I have seen a lot of people who were crying blood. Those people did not have any wrongdoings. Those young girls, it is their time to laugh and play as young people, but they have no rights at all. Under those circumstances, how can I just keep quiet?
And having spent that time in the centre, what do you think the purpose of these centres is?
The total aim of those concentration camps is to eliminate the Uyghur people, the Muslims, torture them. I was released from the concentration camps 3 months ago, but every single day the situation in the concentration camps is in front of my eyes. The cries of the people are in my ears. Please do something and close down those concentration camps. The situation is not like before at all. There is extremely heavy oppression in that part of the world.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Saudi Arabian teenager Rafa Akin has avoided deportation from Bangkok, Thailand, and gained the protection of the UNHCR. But she is desperate to secure protection from the threat of death at the hands of her own family, she says, as she faces having to renounce Islam. Her plight has highlighted the issue of how women are treated in Saudi Arabia. Liam Cochran has the story.
Well, that process is ongoing. The Thai authorities have said they expect it to take around about a week for the United Nations Refugee Agency officials to examine her case for asylum and to make a decision. From there, the process is to try and find a third country that would accept to resettle her. In the meantime, she is being kept in a safe place in the custody of Thai officials, but also with the involvement of the UN Refugee Agency, which has promised to protect her.
Now, what do we know about Rahaf Al-Qunun's visa status since she was intending to come to Australia, and several sources say that she did have an Australian visa?
Well, that's right. A colleague, Sophie McNeil, who was with Rahaf in her room yesterday, cited her visa that was dated the 6th of December. And that was the document that she was intending to travel on. It's not clear. There have been reports that her visa was cancelled while all of this was taking place yesterday. Sophie said that while she was with Rahaf Al-Qunun, the young teenage Saudi woman tried to access her online visa account and it had been disabled. So there's still questions about that. We haven't got a firm answer from the Australian government at this point as to what happened there and whether that visa was cancelled.
Now, how has the Thai authorities' approach to this matter changed over the past couple of days, given that just yesterday it was only a barricaded hotel door that was stopping Rahaf from being on the next flight back to Kuwait?
The Thai position has been a little confusing to keep track of at times. There hasn't been a lot of consistency depending on who is talking. To give you an example, the immigration police chief, Surachat Hakpan, who's better known by his nickname Big Joke, he said yesterday that he recognised that Rahaf Al-Qunun is in real danger, and he said that Thailand will protect her and will not force her on a plane back to Saudi Arabia. But pretty much at the same time he was saying that, the Deputy Prime Minister of the country, General Pravit Wongsuwan, said, "We will not send her to the third country as she requested." Pretty much the opposite of what the immigration police chief had just said. Beyond that, the Thai version of events is confused at best. The immigration police have said that Rahaf didn't have a Thai visa, but she was in a transit area in the airport, so she didn't need to have a visa. The Thais have also said that the Saudi government asked for their help in this case of a runaway teenager, which contradicts the story that she was stopped because she didn't have a visa. The Thai authorities have also not explained the allegations from Rahaf Al-Qunun that her passport and ticket were taken from her, was tricked basically into handing them over by either a Saudi diplomat or a security manager for Kuwait Airlines. There's some differing accounts of that story. There's no explanation as to why someone, a foreign national, is going around taking people's passports from them in the international airport.
So do we learn anything if we have a look at diplomatic relations between Thailand and Saudi Arabia then?
This is a very interesting case. Thailand and Saudi relations have been strained for decades. And it's because of a case that happened some time ago, which has all the traits of a classic heist movie or perhaps a crime thriller. It's known as the Blue Diamond Affair. Back in 1989, a Thai gardener was working for a Saudi prince, and he climbed into his bedroom window and stole some very valuable jewellery. He hid the loot in a vacuum cleaner bag and eventually sent it back to Thailand. Now, much of this jewellery was recovered by police, but when it was returned, the Saudis found that quite a lot of it was fake and that a huge, very valuable blue diamond was still missing. Now, the following year, in 1990, a well-known Saudi businessman that was close to the Saudi royal family travelled to Thailand to investigate, went missing and is presumed to be dead. And just days after that, three members of the Saudi embassy were shot dead, their killers never caught. So as a result of that, Saudi Arabia downgraded diplomatic relations with Thailand. They greatly reduced the migrant workers that were allowed to come into the country, which cost Thailand millions of dollars in remittances. So it's had lasting effects to the relationship. The thief who was involved was actually caught. He was sentenced to 7 years jail, but was released after three. And to this day, some of the more superstitious people here believe that that blue diamond is cursed. And one thing we do know is that the Thai-Saudi relations have never quite recovered. So what all of this means for Rahaf Al-Qunun is unclear. It could be the case that this troubled past means there's less cooperation because of the bad blood, or perhaps Thailand might try and win back the Saudis' favour.
Pollution has surged to emergency levels around northern India, with the capital, New Delhi, blanketed in toxic smog this week. While the city of 20 million people chokes, politicians are being criticized for their lack of action. Here's Slobodan Hinu.
14 of the world's most polluted cities are in India, and New Delhi is the capital of contaminated air. The amount of toxic particulate matter has risen to more than 12 times the internationally accepted safe level, and Delhi's hospitals are groaning under the pressure. 68-year-old lung cancer patient Jagbir Singh was recovering at home after surgery, but the pollution has forced him back into hospital. He tells me he feels a shortness of breath because of the bad air, that he feels like there's a load on his body. Professor Arvind Kumar is a Delhi chest surgeon who says he's now seeing atypical lung cancer patients, more women, non-smokers and people in their 20s and 30s.
If this trend continues, I'm afraid we are going to see an epidemic of lung diseases in our country in the next 5 to 10 years. As a chest surgeon who deals with chest cases every day, I can see this avalanche coming.
Delhi's government often puts a temporary stop to construction or bans trucks from entering the city when the pollution reaches hazardous or emergency levels like it has this week. But the hazard is returning every winter when cold air traps vehicle and industrial emissions, smoke and dust in a cloud of smog that doesn't lift for 3 or 4 months. The World Bank has calculated that healthcare and productivity losses due to pollution cost India around 8% of its GDP, more than $300 billion a year. For Delhi mother Bhavreen Kandari, the cost has been far more personal.
We've lost 2 children in the last 3 years between our family and friends of asthma. So you're not going to wait, you know, as a concerned citizen, what are you going to do?
She's spearheading a collective of concerned Delhiites who call themselves My Right to Breathe. They campaign, protest and lobby politicians and the media.
Desperation, what do you do? I mean, how many emails can you write? How much can you tweet when you see no results? And then you're seeing this damage, irreversible damage happening to you, your loved ones around, to your family.
Bhavreen Kandari hopes the plight of the next generation will be a catalyst for change.
You know, it's only the government will have to wake up. You know, the political will have to come. They will have to come forward. They will have to feel for it because it is their children also suffering.
In 2018, there were 27 recorded shark attacks in Australia, 9 more than the year before, and one was fatal. In the most recent attack last month, a 36-year-old man was mauled while surfing at the Nambucca Heads in the north-southwest mid part of the north coast. The alarming headlines don't seem to have spooked tourists. Locals say it's business as usual. Sarah Mulder reports.
This is Scott's Head, a small coastal village north of Port Macquarie on the New South Wales mid-north coast. There are a few small shops, but the main attraction is the beach, which today is packed with tourists and locals, seemingly undeterred by the shark attack not far from here a few weeks ago.
I mean, the thing is that there's always sharks around.
Is it something that you think about before you get in the water?
No, not really. I surf, so I don't worry about it too much.
Do you ever think about sharks?
Like, a little, like when we're coming out here, but then when I get in the water, it's fine. I don't think about it.
The Nambucca Heads and Valla Chamber of Commerce represents about 87 businesses in the region. Secretary Tony Stokes says it's pretty much business as usual.
From my ringing around, we've not had any effect in terms of tourist trade. The caravan parks are full. The area around the V-wall is full of tourists and kids enjoying themselves. So no, I don't think it's had much of an effect at all. It's only the second attack in 15 years. Most Aussies know that there is a danger anywhere in New South Wales or anywhere around Australia, but no, I don't think they're going to worry too much.
Daryl Mason runs a small shop right on the beach at Scott's Head, selling second-hand clothing, books, CDs and vinyl. He's been at Scott's Head for about 2 years and has always lived by the beach.
I haven't seen any impact on businesses. I don't think, unlike, say, a road closure, it doesn't necessarily get in people's way, so they're still going to do everything they would normally do in a day, and that includes surf. I'd be very surprised if anyone who surfs really gets put off by a shark attack. I don't think it puts people off. I really don't.
Les Turner has been living in the region for more than 38 years. He admits there could be a short-term impact.
I would definitely say there is. People do have a tendency to avoid somewhere if there's been a few shark attacks. It's a chance you take. We don't always think of that before we go surfing. But we haven't realistically had a lot of shark attacks here.
Further up the coast at Ballina, five shark attacks in 2015 had many businesses close to going to the wall. But Tony Stokes says the impact was short-term.
People listened to the media and became a little worried, but over long-term periods, no.
Les Turner agrees and says tourists always return after a shark attack.
They would still come, yeah. I think, you know, a small percentage would maybe think, oh, I'll go somewhere else, but that's their choice. They're always there. It's their territory, not ours. We're the uninvited guests.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Just a quick reminder, those in the Pacific region can catch a 3x daily edition on various medium wave and FM stations in the Pacific. That's all we have time for. We'll see you again in 7 days' time for the General English edition. Until then, so long, take care. Bye-bye.